This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Trials are set for this winter for the alleged members of a drug-dealing operation that brought in tens of thousands of dollars a day on Milwaukee's north side. The members referred to it as BMA, and a feature in the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine says the group changed the way drug dealing happens in this city.
Senior editor Matt Rohde wrote the piece, and he joins us to explain. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Talk about why we should be interested in this group, gang, loosely referred to as a gang, BMA. Who are they and why are they important in the grand scheme of maybe understanding the drug trade in Milwaukee?
Yeah, they're somewhat illustrative of the larger trend of gangs moving away from the more like rigid and structured gangs of the past, like the Gangster Disciples and Vice Lords, which often, especially in the kind of like greater Chicago network of gangs, it sometimes involves some pretty detailed ideologies and literature. And it was a pretty like complex ecosystem. And now things have become a lot more compartmentalized, a lot more based on neighborhood and who's friends with who, which is interesting. And social media seems to have played a role in atomizing the landscape of people, primarily creating organizations to do illegal drug sales. And so this gang was one that was pretty high profile in Milwaukee, one that had developed quite a reputation. And it turned into this big kind of war almost between MPD and BMA, the big money addicts.
Well, and we call it a gang. I mean, this is really, and this is going to sound flip, and it's not, I don't intend it that way, but it's sort of one part gang, one part small business. We're only talking about four people here, really.
They worked schedules and bounced around in ways that would even make the busiest pizza delivery guy's head spin. And they were somewhat unusual in that they didn't work themselves up the hierarchy. They kept doing the street-level sales themselves, which meant that they didn't have any other employees or runners to pay or keep on a payroll. So they were just like sucking in all this money. And the lead guy, Rashawn Smith, as he's been charged, he was sort of customer service oriented. The kind of number two guy, Keon Lewis, not so much, but had more of a reputation for shorting people, whatever amount of heroin typically they had purchased. This was a group that maintained something of a hotline and had business cards that they put out.
This is mostly heroin we're talking about. How big a player were they in the Milwaukee heroin scene, if you will?
They could do multiple thousands of dollars in sales every day to about 50 customers on average, traveling a few hundred miles in a day.
Right, you say they sometimes put 400 miles, like the distance between here and Cincinnati, in the course of just a day of going around these neighborhoods.
Right. Through GPS tracking, through some means, MPD tracked that they had gone about 400 miles, or that I think a car driven by Rashawn, I believe, had gone about 400 miles, which was shocking to him because he just kind of got into the flow, apparently, of doing it and wasn't even aware of the sheer number of miles that he was putting on his car. And they cycled through quite a few stolen cars. They had a group of car thieves or people that received stolen cars that they would stay in contact with. And quite a few seemed to have come from rental car places, stolen from rental car lots, some in Illinois, I think, and some in maybe in Wisconsin.
Right. I kept coming back to was actually something that an expert you spoke with for this piece said kind of late in the piece. You know, there's really a certain amount of entrepreneurship that sounds like it was driven, that was driving this enterprise.
Yeah, this guy John Hagedorn from the University of Illinois at Chicago is kind of like the guy on Chicago gangs. He did a really interesting study in 1998 in Milwaukee. He did some work here, including running a gang diversion program, where they took kind of an anonymous census of drug dealing in a couple chunks of land, one on the north side, one on the south side. And they found that something like 10% of the younger adult men were involve some way receiving some kind of income from drug dealing, whether they were working as a lookout or runner or whatever. And most of the drug dealers had other jobs. This was, and they might only do drug dealing a couple, 2-3 days out of the month at the start of the month when people had more income. So, people have this image of the dealer who's riding around in the fancy car with expensive rims and all that stuff, but that's not always the case.
In fact, there's kind of a really vivid scene image that you paint in this that the guys from this group really didn't seem to spend much of the money, you know, at all. Really, the idea was that they just kind of had it.
It's very strange. It just always comes up with drug dealing cases is of like, well, if you guys are raking in this much money every day, like, where was it going? And sometimes it does get stored in houses somewhere because obviously you don't want to keep $50,000 where you sleep because somebody will come and rob you. But, yeah, these guys had some jewelry, like really expensive sunglasses. The stolen cars, they weren't really flashy. They were, like, you know, just sort of sometimes compact cars or SUVs. And as a rule, the money is supposed to be fanned out to different places and or possibly laundered in some way. I think it's a really hard investigation to be successful with.
Why were they such a thorn in MPD's side?
They were in some ways abusing the department's pursuit policy, which said that previously, this is right in the middle of being changed right now, but previously, unless the people inside the vehicle are involved in the commission of a violent crime, they can, if they run away from the traffic stop, you're generally not supposed to chase them. And so what the BMA guys would do, they would let the cop pull them over, then the cop would get out of his car, and then they would speed off. Where, if they understood the policy, I guess it wouldn't matter, like, if the officer got out or not. But so they just got in the routine of doing this over and over. Then some other guys realized and heard from them. It spread around the grapevine. And then you had other dealers who were doing the same thing. And they also frequently would tint their cars' windows. So they collectively became known as the violent crime tint crew within MPD. Yeah, I'm sure it was frustrating to a lot of officers. And then once BMA started branching out into more violent crime, then they became, it seems like they became a top shelf priority at that point.
Well, and so then what was their undoing?
For one, they marketed themselves pretty heavily. And by fleeing, they were antagonizing MPD. They were making themselves visible to MPD. And
also said there's no middle management. There are no kind of underlings for the MPD to go get.
Right. It's like the CEO and the COO are like in the car doing deliveries for Pizza Hut or what have you. Yeah. So they're always kind of exposed. And even MPD was able to get video footage of at least one of them when they did controlled buys because, sure, the windows are tinted, but you have to roll down the window to, like, do the drug transaction. Yeah, so they were just – they had people above them, too, that provided them with the amounts of heroin that they split up and sold. Yeah, so they stayed on as foot soldiers for a long time, and it made them more exposed. And then once, like, a homicide investigation gets involved, it – gets a lot more decisive.
If their objective was to stay off the MPD's radar screen, they were going about it the entirely wrong way.
Yeah, I think they're partially lulled into a sense of security because when you're a low-level drug player, there's plenty of other stuff for law enforcement to be concerned about. So I think some of these people think that they can beat the cops or the cops just don't care about them or that they can always kind of wiggle out of it. But then stepping out of something more serious like robberies or homicides, and then all of a sudden they can't get out of it and they're facing 10, 20 years in prison.
Right. As we're having this conversation, there is still one of their cases is pending, right?
Right. One of them's kind of up in the air. There's a sentencing happening at the end of this month, Rashawn's. And there's a couple that are still scheduled for jury trials early next year, which will be interesting. And the trials that are planned are, they're sort of a mile wide and like 6 inches deep. Because police prosecutors are going after them with RICO racketeering type statute under state law, which means that and I looked up what racketeering was because you hear it a lot.
Right. They're operating a racket.
Yeah. And then a racket is something, it's like, it's an industry that that is corrupt and creates its own demand. Like gambling, like you wouldn't have demand for gambling unless gambling existed in the first place because it can become compulsive. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with these guys. It's pretty disheartening from their perspective because they're kind of lined up for some pretty long prison terms at this point.
Must have been a complicated story to tell.
Yeah, it was a lot of records to come through and not a whole lot of people who are interested in being interviewed. I guess when it comes to drug cases, it's a pretty wide network of people that don't want things to be talked about necessarily.
And presumably the police and the prosecutors don't want to show their hand.
Yeah, while cases are still ongoing, that was the difficult part with this.
Well, Matt Rohde, thank you very much.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here.
Matt Rohde is a senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine. His article called The Notorious BMA is in the September issue.